Our second case this morning is 2016-263, Cincinnati Bar Association versus Christopher David Wiest.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court, George Johnson for respondent Christopher Wiest. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. There were four rule violations asserted in this disciplinary complaint against respondent. Two of them were dismissed by the hearing panel. One of those dismissed was the Rule 1.6 allegation. The reason, the rationale for the dismissal of that claim is set forth in paragraph 48 of the report and recommendation. The panel found that respondent had not been given notice that the relator intended to prove that he had violated Rule 1.6 by disclosing client documents in response to a subpoena from the SEC and from testifying before the SEC pursuant to subpoena. The relator never gave the respondent notice of those, and the hearing panel dismissed that count. And yet, the hearing panel went forward on an 8.4B violation and actually found that the respondent had violated 8.4B by violating Ohio Revised Code Section 1333.81, which is a trade secret statute, by doing the exact same thing, by producing documents to the SEC pursuant to a subpoena. And we respectfully submit that that count, 1.8, should have been dismissed for the very same reason. Respondent had no notice that relator intended to prove this set of facts. The 8.4B violation had been in all four complaints in this case. In the original complaint and the first two amendments, it was specifically tied to the federal securities law, Rule 10B. And then in the final amended complaint, the third amended complaint, the securities law allegations were removed, and there was a parenthetical that respondent had violated Rule 8.4B by engaging in illegal conduct, paren example, and then it was the attorney-client privilege statute 2717.13, and the trade secret statute. There were no facts in the complaint that put the respondent on notice of the facts that they were going to allege constituted the violation, and there was nothing in discovery that gave him notice. So it should be dismissed based on Daugherty for lack of notice. If you turn to the substance of it, 1333.81 is a trade secret statute which protects an employer when he gives confidential information to an employee. The panel's finding fundamentally misconstrues who owns client confidential information. Client confidential information belongs to the client, not the law firm. When the client in this case disclosed the very same documents to the SEC that respondent disclosed, 2 months before, 3 months before a respondent disclosed them, the client waived confidentiality as to those documents. In fact, a panel found that in finding there was no violation of the attorney-client privilege statute. They said that the client waived the privilege by giving those documents to the
SEC. Was your client aware of that?
My client was not aware of it at the time, but he received those documents when he testified at the SEC as exhibits and realized that they had been given. And although prejudice isn't necessary to prove that my client is entitled to notice of what he's being charged with, he was prejudiced because he made his disclosure to the SEC through his attorney. His attorney redacted some of those documents. His attorney told him, we're going to produce documents and you are going to testify. And we could have asked his attorney, had we known that this was going to be a basis for a rule violation allegation, what information did you get from the SEC? Did you understand that the client had already produced these documents? Did that go into your thinking when you told the respondent to testify before the SEC? But we don't need to get that far. The client waived, and whether the respondent knew that the client had waived or not, the waiver is an objective fact. And so the Rule 8.4B violation should be overturned by this court for either of those reasons, because he had no notice of it, or because substantively the finding is flawed.
Then what's left? If
the only thing left is the 8.4C violation, which is conduct involving dishonesty, deceit, misrepresentation, or fraud. And the hearing panel found that that rule was violated because the respondent traded based on insider information. Now, The panel's finding shows that they didn't, I think, shows pretty clearly that they didn't make that conclusion based on clear and convincing evidence. First of all, the only evidence that was produced was the evidence from respondent and the documentary evidence. And respondent, explanation for why he didn't think the transaction was going forward is detailed on pages 25 through 27 of our brief, and I'm going to talk about some of those facts. But the very first thing that you need to address is what was the confidential information that respondent is alleged to have traded on. The relator continues to try and throw in this mix the very existence of the publicly traded company that respondent purchased stock of. The existence of a publicly traded company is not confidential information. The confidential information that needs to be evaluated is the client, Stanley's, negotiation for acquisition of that publicly traded company. So if the respondent purchased his stock based on a belief that his client was going to purchase this Infologic, this publicly traded company, then he's committed insider trading and he's violated Rule 8.4C.
But no didn't Black & Decker ask him if they should acquire? And wasn't it then his determination as to how he would advise them?
No, sir.
That's all wrong.
That's
They never approached him on that subject?
No. The Thompson Hine, his employer, and Mr. Respondent specifically were involved in a very small piece of the due diligence. They were involved in the environmental due diligence. They did not give, they didn't negotiate the deal. They didn't give any financial advice. They didn't advise the client to go forward or not.
Was their information the linchpin for the determination on whether they would proceed with the deal?
There wasn't any direct testimony on that, but this was environmental cleanup information.
So they needed to know their exposure for untold hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more.
Exactly. And that's an interesting question, Chief Justice, because one of the reasons that respondent concluded that the deal wasn't going forward, I mean, the first event, the big event, was that on October 21st, the day he got his assignment, the stock got delisted by the NASDAQ. So it dropped. It didn't have a high enough capitalization. It dropped down to being traded on the pink slips. On that same day, he gets his assignment, do this environmental due diligence.
And he knew this before he got the assignment, the
No.
status of this company and on the stock exchange?
It all happened on the same day. He learned that the stock, it became delisted, he learned it was delisted, and he got the assignment all on October 21st.
In that order?
The order's not in the record. I don't know.
I mean, why would he be looking at this stock getting delisted and knowing about it and then, oh, what a coincidence, I have this company now to deal with?
I think he clearly got the information through the client.
Okay.
But his experience with this client was that they completed a due diligence project regardless of whether they were going to go forward with the transaction or not. So he gets the assignment on the 21st. He realizes, he understands that the stock has been delisted. He doesn't turn his assignment around until the 27th. The client actually bugs him through their agent on the 26th. Hey, where's the result of this? He gives it on the 27th. He gets another follow-up assignment on the 27th. He asks a follow-up question on November 2nd and gives the response, finally gives his answer on November 5th.
But hadn't he acquired shares of the stock in the interim?
Absolutely had.
Pardon me, please?
He absolutely had. He bought his stock the first time on October 28th, and then he bought again between November 8th and November 16th. But his experience with this client was the client...
Knowing that it had been delisted, he was acquiring the stock. All right.
And that was what attracted him about it. He is a guy that buys delisted stocks because he plays the fluctuation. So, as I said, the reasons for his purchase are set forth. They include the client's lack of, I mean, his belief that the client was no longer going forward allowed him to buy this based on the delisting. So that was the basis that he bought the stock.
And he didn't think to just clarify that?
No, he didn't, and that is absolutely negligent, and we never contested
that. You would agree that that would be required under these circumstances to consult with, at the very least, your supervisors at the law firm, who would then recommend probably either don't do it,
right.
You're putting us in a very difficult situation,
right.
Or, you know, see if the client was would agree to that, do the release.
Absolutely. And that's, and the conduct fell below the standard of care. There's no question.
But you don't think that's a violation of the professional code?
Well, it's not a violation of 8.4C. which is deceit, dishonesty, misrepresentation, or fraud. It's none of those.
What is it?
It would be 8.4H. It would be other conduct that that isn't particularly prescribed in the rules that questions the lawyer's character and fitness to practice. It is, the negligence is a violation of the code, but it's not a violation of what was charged. So the panel is clearly uncomfortable with the charge. In paragraphs 85 and 86, 85, the panel says, first, the panel concludes respondent purchased the stock based on non-public confidential information. The next line, under respondent's logic, a purchaser of stock with insider information could simply assert the purchase was based on some other factor and insider trading could never be proven. The next paragraph, 86, the panel cannot accept respondent's claim that he believed the deal was not moving forward. Respondent relies on the wording of emails and artificial deadlines as evidence. However, respondent knew or should have known the uncertainty of the deal would preclude his purchase of the stock. Knew or should have known is the language of negligence. And so this respondent should not be found to have violated 8.4C, which is among the most onerous rules that one can be found to have violated. It questions, it implies intent to mislead, deceive, or be dishonest.
Do you say that your client did not know that he should have attempted to obtain informed consent from the client or the employer to purchase stock?
No.
He didn't know that?
No, he should have done that. He should have
done
that.
And he made a conscious decision not to do that.
He made a conclusion that he has regretted ever since.
I answer the question. He made a conscious decision not to ask his client for a release or his employer for their input on him purchasing this stock during this window.
Right. And I wasn't avoiding your question. He did not make a conscious decision. It didn't cross his mind, which is, as I said, below the standard of care. It would have been an easy thing for him to do. And if you think about, if he had actually been intending to purchase on inside information, he would have asked somebody, is this still going forward? Because the delisting would make you think that the deal is not going forward or the deal has changed, as it did him. And if he was going to invest money hoping that the deal was going to go forward, he would have asked somebody, is this still going to happen? Perhaps.
If he didn't think what he did was, it didn't cross his mind, why would it cross his mind to do what you just said he should have done, or he was evidence of lack of intent?
I'm saying if he believed the deal was going forward and he wanted to trade on insider information, he would have confirmed that the deal was still going forward with somebody after this major event had happened, the delisting of the target. He didn't do that.
Was it delisted?
October 21st. Yes, the date he got.
And he got an assignment, and then he got another assignment on the, I believe you said the 28th, and then he had to get his work product in, and they were bugging him, and he got it in the first week in November.
Yes.
So he knew there was some activity on this deal.
Right, and that's
Don't you think that's sufficient notice for an attorney to trigger the need to obtain informed consent from a client?
It certainly is enough to trigger the need for informed consent. And he absolutely should have done that. There's no question about that. But his experience with his client was that when they were in a rush, they said they were in a rush. And the timeline that he got when he got the materials was the deal was supposed to be signed on October 30. The client was very lackadaisical about this. So that's one of the things that went into his thinking, that this wasn't going forward. So he violated the professional code, but he didn't violate 8.4C. And one of the things that I want to bring to your attention is what happened the date that the acquisition got announced. On December 15th, when it was publicly announced that Stanley was acquiring InfoLogic, instead of celebrating that he had, you know, correctly traded on inside information and made a nice profit, he panicked, found a securities lawyer, called the securities lawyer and said, I made a mistake. I thought this deal wasn't going forward. I bought it. What should I do? He paid the lawyer $5,000. He followed the lawyer's advice. And then he waived the attorney-client privilege with regard to his conversation with that lawyer. So we know that's what happened on December 15th. It's stipulated to. So was he negligent? Yes. Did he violate the failure to get informed consent to get around 1.6, the client confidentiality? Probably. Wasn't charged that way. and he's not guilty of what he was charged of. I have about 30 seconds left, and I'd like to save it.
Are you saying that this case should be dismissed in toto, or are you arguing for a mitigated sanction?
I'm arguing that the case should be dismissed. The findings that were made aren't based on the evidence, and the 8.4B should be dismissed for lack of notice. 8.4C should be dismissed because there isn't clear and convincing evidence that he's violated 8.4C.
Well,
and
didn't you just acknowledge, though, that he violated?
Probably violated 1.6 if it had been correctly charged.
And we can't, with that admission, find that's the violation and provide a sanction?
I'm not aware of this court ever pulling out a new rule violation that hadn't been charged.
I thought it was dismissed. 1.6 was charged and dismissed.
It was dismissed because it wasn't. There wasn't a factual basis given.
It would be reinstitution of the rule violation 1.6 by this court based on.
That's true. You could resurrect it. I misspoke. It was charged and dismissed. Although you get into the question then of whether you can review a rule that's been dismissed by the hearing panel, and this court's law pretty clearly as you can't. Once it's been dismissed by a hearing panel, it's not subject to review.
What should we do with the admission that you've just made to Justice Piper in connection with that?
It's an admission that was readily made during the case. He admitted that he was wrong to do it at the hearing. It's not our responsibility to draft the charges. I mean, the charges that were drafted, we didn't get notice of, and, you know, if you conclude that the correct charges weren't drafted, not my responsibility.
It's not the issue of whether the correct charge was drafted under 1.6. It was dismissed because of lack of notice, was it not?
Right. So if they had charged in the complaint, if they had alleged that you, and actually, I mean, 1.6 is a revealing client confidence, and that's why it went wrong. It would be actually 1.8 using client confidential information, but you need to find that there was a harm to the client. And it's stipulated that there's no harm to the client here. So it would have to be negligence under a different rule. And the rule that comes to mind is 1.4H, which was never charged.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Lugbill?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Ann Lugbill. I am here representing the Cincinnati Bar Association, the respondent. This is an unusual case, and in light of the prior argument regarding attorney-client privilege, I think that's a central issue here, is what is an attorney's duty when the attorney has been contacted by a client for the purpose of seeking and obtaining legal advice, which is exactly what occurred here. And we saw in the prior argument how important that privilege is, how the ownership of the privilege is so important that it's inherent prejudice, in Justice Langsner's words, as to the importance of an attorney protecting that privilege. Here we have an attorney who received confidential information October 21st, thereupon did investigation of this proposed acquisition of Infologic and learned that Infologic had been delisted, not the other way around. The testimony is pretty clear on that order. He'd never heard of Infologic before the client email. He didn't know anything about the company, perhaps know about the company but not know the name. There's just no information that he had about Infologic's prior to getting the communication from the client. And as the panel found, it is inherently unbelievable that he did not use that information received from the client in making his determination to engage in purchasing the stock that was the of Infologic, the target of his client's acquisition activities. To answer the Chief Justice's question with regard to the importance of the environmental review, there was testimony by a representative of Stanley Black & Decker via stipulation that the deals of this type do not go forward absent completion of the environmental review. And while it may have been a piece of a very big puzzle, it was part of the due diligence operations of a publicly traded company. You don't knowingly take on a Superfund site that you don't know about. You have to do this property review to determine if there are claims outstanding regarding anything that Infologic owns or perhaps owned in the past, a gas station, whatever it might be.
Is this the first time that Mr. Wiest had done this kind of study for an acquisition?
No, Your Honor. The testimony was that he had done about 20 of these for Stanley Black & Decker, that there was a long course of activity. And in fact, I think the panel alluded to it in the hearing, and I can't remember if it's in the findings, but they found it very important that he had this course of dealing over several years. He knew what was important to the client, what timing was, what happened to deals, and he was using all of that information in making his erroneous conclusion that it was okay for him to purchase Echologic stock.
My question is based, or I asked that question because what is represented is that, well, for all appearances, it looked like it was going to be a ditched deal. They weren't going to do it because of the lackadaisical, timelines and attitude of the client. But if you're telling me that he dealt with his client 20 previous times and did this kind of work for them, you know, and the pattern was established for how they do their work and how he does his work in response to the assignments.
Yes, Your Honor, there's ample evidence in the record, and it's all in the form of testimony of Mr. Wiest, that in these 20 deals, about only once or twice, and I think he finally confirmed twice, did he actually get a deal deadline, which he points to as critical in his decision-making here, that he was not told whether a deal was going forward or not going forward. Sometimes he didn't know for years that a deal had not gone forward. He even got a call one time where he had been told the deal was shelved and got called back years later and said, let's open this back up again. He was not in the decision-making loop. He was not in the sphere that the company felt obligated to communicate every detail of the transaction. These are, in their stipulations in the record, these are highly secret transactions because if the information gets out in the public, then there are all kinds of SEC repercussions, some of which...
The work that he did for them in this environmental arena, essentially, he doesn't even leave the office. He doesn't go out and inspect the property. He does a computer search.
That's correct.
Of what's on file.
Yes.
What's on record. So if Black & Decker wanted to really know if there are environmental issues, they'd hire professionals to do a phase one or a phase two, go out and actually inspect the property and determine whether or not they need to do borings and all that kind of stuff. He doesn't do any of that, right?
He does not do that. We don't know whether that was done. His original contact came from an outside environmental consulting firm. Mr. Simon, whose testimony is in the record by way of stipulation, was the initial contact between Stanley Black & Decker and Mr. Wiest. So we don't know what other environmental due diligence may have been done by that firm.
So his original engagement was by the environmental consultant rather than Stanley Black & Decker?
The environmental consultant was basing the engagement upon directives from Stanley Black & Decker's Debbie Geyer. Geyer was the primary contact that the client, that Mr. Wiest had with Stanley Black & Decker, his client, over these 20 prior transactions.
So someone at Stanley Black & Decker directed the environmental consultant. This is our environmental lawyer that we want to have do the due diligence record search.
Yes, that's our understanding.
Yeah.
There may not have been as many explicit communications because of this course of conduct over the past years. Mr. Wiest worked under a partner, Andrew Kolesar, who had a longstanding relationship with Stanley Black & Decker.
So would it be fair to say then that his so-called inside information was secondhand? It was intuitive on his part. If the environmental consultant is coming to him on behalf of Black & Decker, that something's going on at Black & Decker rather than direct information from somebody at Black & Decker.
it was not entirely secondhand. Included with the materials that was sent to Mr. Wiest on October 21 was this internal PowerPoint, which was the planning process, information that had been given to the board of directors in authorization of going forward with exploring this transaction.
Okay, so.
It was a very detailed document that includes synergies, the interests that Infologics was a healthcare-related company, and how this battery and machinery company's operations somehow merged with this healthcare company, very internal to the company.
So he knows that this has gotten beyond low-level planners at Black & Decker. There's something, a document prepared going to the board of directors.
Yes.
So that's, at that point, he knows it's a go or no go is at an advanced stage at Black & Decker.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. In fact, in the record, Mr. Raskin, who was a vice president involved in these exploring acquisitions for the company, testified that his reviews resulted in about 1% of the companies being a subject of an acquisition. Mr. Wiest is at a much later stage of that. He's in that category where 10 of the 20 acquisitions that he does due diligence environmental reviews for actually result in an acquisition.
So they're farther down the road towards occurring.
Yes.
Not just the initial. And with regard to his relationship with the environmental a company that was also working for Black & Decker, do they submit reports to Mr. Wiest? Is that part of his due diligence to have their reports in the package that he analyzes?
That's not my understanding. My understanding is he was given addresses and some information, company names of perhaps companies that Infologics had done work with, do some sort of computer review.
Okay.
Make sure there's not a time bomb out there that
and
would.
During this review, he was acquiring the stock.
Yes, he got the information October 21. On October 27th, he still hadn't done the work, but was told, you know, we need this. October, he finishes the review at approximately the same time that he buys the stock.
All right.
Counsel, what you've told us, I mean, it appears the use of confidential information of the client for his own benefit, but that comes under 1.6. And the panel dismissed those charges. I'm concerned about the technicalities here. And as Mr. Johnson has pointed out, 8.4C relates to conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Are you suggesting that any of these factual statements that you've made rise to that level?
Your Honor, I think our position, first of all, with several steps here, if you don't mind, Rule 1.6A, we think can be fully reviewed by this panel.
Even though it was dismissed?
Yes, this is a report and recommendation of the panel, and this court has always taken the view that it is doing a de novo review and can do that de novo review.
Do you have a case for us, though, where we've actually resurrected something that was dismissed by the panel?
I think the only thing I have is the case law that we've cited in our briefs that talks about this being a de novo review by this court.
Right, but the real issue here, because we've had other cases where the panel has dismissed certain counts, and I don't recall that we have actually gone in and resurrected something that's been dismissed. I may be incorrect on that.
Well, Your Honor, the reason it was dismissed was ultimately because the panel believed that that Stanley Black & Decker had waived the attorney-client privilege at the SEC. We do not agree with that. We think it's extremely important to send a message that only the client can waive the attorney-client privilege, and there was no testimony by Stanley Black & Decker that it had waived. There's simply a conclusion that because information had been turned over by the SEC, that amounted to a waiver that then gave the attorney the ability to talk about whatever he wanted with regard to the client relationship. We don't think that's the law. The SEC proceedings were closed. The record remains closed. That's why we have a confidentiality order in this case that's still binding.
Well, what does one do if you're the lawyer and you're in front of the SEC and in their direct examination of he was a target at that point, right?
At the time he was questioned, I don't believe he had gotten the Wells letter.
Okay.
But whether there's a target letter, we don't have that in the record.
But if in the course of asking him questions, if they hand him the documents that are privileged, that they already have, wouldn't one assume that there's what's he supposed to say? Oh, I can't talk about this because this is privileged, even though you have it?
Your Honor, I believe that process should have occurred, but the process that really should have occurred starts back when, at least when he received the subpoena. He should have gone to his law firm. They want our documents. They want our information. Then he should have, with the law firm, approached the client, found out what the client had waived and not waived. Perhaps they had some sort of an agreement with the SEC. Perhaps the SEC had gotten a court order from the district court. We don't know any of that. But there was nothing that sanctioned him turning over that information and those documents to the SEC. When he got to the hearing, the SEC, rather than using his own documents, pulled out the copies that had been produced by the client.
Just refresh my memory. Did the SEC say, bring all these documents with you?
My understanding is they were provided well in advance of the actual investigation area.
What do you mean they were provided well in advance?
They were subpoenaed. The documents were subpoenaed.
Of whom?
Of Mr. Wiest.
Okay.
As well as, at a later date, his law firm, and at a prior date, of Stanley Black & Decker.
Okay.
And then after that production, which included redactions by Mr. Chase, Mr. Wiest's lawyer, Mr. Chase, the Florida lawyer who was engaged to defend him in possible criminal SEC activities, made a determination of what Stanley Black & Decker's privileges were, which is completely inappropriate. And then he appears at the hearing and finds out that the Bates numbers on the documents indicate that they were produced not by him but by the client. And at that point, there should have been, I still believe, an obligation to assert the attorney-client privilege. Please advise whether the client has waived it and find that out. But because he didn't communicate.
You've lost me. Are you saying that the respondent here, through his attorney, produced, after a subpoena was issued, his client's documents before he went to the hearing?
Yes.
He handed them over before?
Yes.
Without consulting Black & Decker?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. I see you
have... Could you briefly address the response again to Justice Lansinger's question? As Mr. Johnson suggests, this is not an 8.4C violation. He suggests it's an 8.4H, if anything, but that wasn't charged. How do you characterize this?
Your Honor, we believe he's violated both 8.4C and 8.4B, that he engaged in conduct involving dishonesty. He used client information to trade on the stock, even though he knew insider trading was illegal. He did not come forward after he made the $56,000 profit. He did not come forward when subpoenaed. He did not come forward either to his law firm or to his client that they were being investigated because of his activities. He didn't advise the client that he had waived the privilege at the hearing or in producing documents. And he was doing all of this to protect himself and to hide from his client and his law firm what had actually happened.
What is the sanction that you're seeking in this case?
Your Honor, we support the sanction that was recommended by the panel and by the board, which is two-year suspension with 18 months stayed. We think it's very important to send a message to attorneys of the importance of protecting the privilege of not trading in client information, whether it's purchasing real estate property or purchasing stock.
Is there any recommendation you have with respect to the profit that was generated here? I think you said it was $56,000.
Your Honor, in his settlement with the SEC, he paid approximately $120,000 in penalties, disgorgement, and interest. However, we cannot find anything in the record that indicates he ever paid the client the $56,000, which we think under the United States versus O'Hagan decision, under Ohio law, because he made that profit using the client's information as and while in this fiduciary agency relationship, he actually owes the profits back to the client. So we think there's even a financial aspect
even
to this.
Even without a showing of detriment to the client?
Your Honor, we think that being embroiled in an SEC investigation, hiring outside counsel, having three of your people interrogated by the SEC, as well as getting involved in these proceedings and jeopardizing your own roadmap to how you acquire outside companies, what's important to you, how you communicate with the board, as was done here, that's sufficient harm, and it needs to be sufficient harm. Otherwise, we have a whole host of activities attorneys might possibly engage in.
Are there other instances you found similar to this where attorneys have engaged in insider trading and profited? Does your research show any cases like that?
The case that we cited in the brief is the case from Wisconsin and Minnesota. It was an attorney who traded on inside information, made a profit of $1,300. He was suspended for 9 months by both states. We have found very few cases. We have not found other identical cases. What happens in most insider trading cases, there's a proceeding before the SEC where they are actually disbarred from practicing before the SEC. Because this attorney wasn't directly appearing in front of the SEC, he was way down the pathway, that action wasn't taken.
Thank you.
Counsel, did you file any objection to the recommended dismissals?
We did file an objection on the dismissal as to Rule 1.8B, that you cannot use information to the disadvantage of a client. We think the panel...
What about 1.6?
1.6, no, we did not.
So just for 1.8?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired, and we simply submit that the panel's decision is entitled to deference. They listened to Mr. Wiest for a very long period of time. They questioned himself, and they looked at a voluminous record in this matter. And we think it's important to send a message to attorneys of the propriety of...
Before you sit down, there's been the argument that this was negligence as opposed to intentional. And the language in the report of the board or the panel is new or should have known, and that doesn't meet the requirements.
Your Honor, we think that every action this attorney took was intentional. He may not have intended to get into trouble, just as Mr. Hauck yesterday didn't intend to get into trouble, but he intended all of the acts that he took. Furthermore, we don't agree with the statement in paragraph 86 that if the deal was dead, that he could trade using client information. We don't think that that's accurate as well. It was client information, as was the 20 prior transaction history client information, and that was all part of his decision-making as to whether the deal was dead. He still possessed information he would not have otherwise had and used it for his own financial benefit.
But the black and white requirement is if you're going to use information that you acquire by virtue of your representation, your relationship with a client, no matter how you've obtained it, you've obtained it in that relationship, no matter what you do with it, if it is to your personal gain, you have to ask the client for permission to do so.
Certainly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Chief Justice, you would be adding an element to Rule 1.8 that isn't there. The rule prohibits the use of client confidential information by a lawyer to the harm of the client, not to the benefit of the lawyer.
Do you think that the client was harmed here?
No. No. Well, there was a stipulation that none of the trading activity, none of the acquisition activity was harmed. It's all been stipulated.
Cincinnati Bar, it seemed to me, first of all, if your client didn't own the stock, somebody else would have. So it's a wash in terms of what they had to pay for the acquisition. But Cincinnati Bar makes the point that his client ended up with considerable grief and expenditure in being hauled in front of the SEC.
A couple of responses.
So wouldn't that be a harm?
Well, theoretically, it could be a harm.
Well, let's get personal. Who's their lawyer now?
Thompson Hine.
Still?
I assume. I mean, Mr. Weiss lost his job. I don't think Thompson Hine lost the client. I can't say that's not in the record, but that's my understanding.
Okay, that's surprising, actually.
Would they be before the SEC without Mr. Weiss' activities?
We don't know. I mean, they ended up bringing a fraud suit against the company that they acquired. There was other litigation. So we don't know if there were other inquiries. We don't know if Stanley started the SEC investigation based on the information they got. If we had had notice that there was no harm to the client pled, if you look at our discovery, which is in the record, we asked repeatedly, what is the harm under 1.8? And what we got was your conduct is the harm. We don't need to show client harm. You violated the rule. So we had no notice. We could have asked Stanley that question. The statement that was just made that perhaps the client was entitled to $56,000 that they didn't get. Not only have we never heard that, not only was that never pled, and nobody ever knew to ask Stanley if they got the money.
That statement doesn't really make any sense. I agree.
Well, I want to point the court to the stipulations in paragraph 38, where the parties stipulated the imposition of other penalties or sanctions by respondents' payment to the SEC of $56,000 in penalties, as well as full restitution of all profits made plus interest in the amount. So not only were we not aware that there was an allegation that we hadn't paid the right person, if in fact we didn't pay the right person, but they stipulated that we made full restitution. The message that needs to get sent here is that the relators in disciplinary cases need to plead the allegations and the facts that support those allegations. We can't wander into a courtroom where somebody's license is at stake and then get ambushed. And that's what happened here, and that's what continues to happen.
But you realize, or you do agree, that if we find that your client acted with dishonesty and deceit, that allegation stuck. That is part of the findings by the panel and agreed to by the board. And if we find that, you know, we determine that to be accurate, then we can, you know, mete out whatever discipline, correct?
Absolutely.
All right.
If you find intentional dishonest conduct, then there's an 8.C violation. Let me just address the sanction in 2 seconds. This isn't a time-off case. This is a negligence case that was improperly pled, and this man shouldn't be off the practice of law for 6 months.
Thank you.
Do you have any cases that talk about the effect of a dismissal and this court's ability to review case counts that have been dismissed?
Yes, Your Honor. We've cited three of those in our brief. I'm not aware, like you, of any case that says that you can review a case that's been a count that's been dismissed by the panel. All the law that you've issued says, that's directly on point, says that you don't review counts that were dismissed or cases that were dismissed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision.